I'm Montse Alvarado. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
There's only one pro-life candidate in this race, and it's Donald Trump.
The pro-life movement and the race for the White House. But is there truly a candidate that honors the dignity of life in all stages?
We're trying to mitigate what looks to be a disaster and a falling apart at the center of the commitment of the Republican Party on pro-life.
Marjorie Dannenfelser of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life weighs in on the GOP platform shift on abortion and the two high-profile Republicans who are now cherry-picking pro-life stances.
We're going to see ongoing challenges to the interpretation of state constitutional law.
Legal analysis on state constitutional amendments seeking to enshrine abortion as a so-called right.
Passersby that see what we're doing, we want to get attention. We want to be very visible as we witness to life.
And building a culture of life, one pedal push at a time. The national ride underway that raises prayer, money, and hope for mothers in need.
Well, I think our platform has to reflect our nominee. And our nominee's position is actually happens to be one grounded in reality. The reality of it is the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And what that basically means is that now it's not states, it's voters at individual states who will get to decide how and to what level they want to restrict abortion, if at all. Some states will have restrictions, some states will not.
Senator Marco Rubio on Sunday said he supports leaving abortion up to the states in an apparent about-face on his once staunch pro-life stance that supported a federal ban on abortion. That same day, GOP Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio and potential Republican vice president also pulled a 180, openly supporting access to the abortion pill mifepristone when he spoke on NBC's Meet the Press. March for Life President Jeannie Mancini called J.D. Vance's comments supporting access to the abortion pill hugely disappointing on X. Both Rubio and Vance's remarks came just a day before the GOP's language on abortion slightly changed. The Republican National Convention adopted new language Monday on the party's platform on abortion, suggesting to leave it to the states, a position held by former President Donald Trump. However, the GOP also included language on the 14th Amendment's protections for life. Meantime, in a letter he sent to Democrats following the holiday weekend, President Joe Biden used fear tactics, saying in part that Trump and MAGA Republicans, quote, are going after everything from contraception to IVF to the right to marry who you love. And they have made it clear they will ban abortion nationwide. We will let none of that happen. We will make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again. The presidential election is just a few months away. Six states will have abortion on the ballot come November, and seven are considering the measure. The six states voting on abortion are Colorado, Florida, Maryland, Nevada, New York, and South Dakota. The seven states considering the measure include Arkansas, Arizona, Iowa, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania. Former President Trump continues to iterate that abortion should be left up to the states, while Biden calls for it to be a constitutional right. Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, joins us in studio now to help digest how the pro-life movement moves forward after the Supreme Court's decisions, the presidential debate, and the potential shift in the GOP's abortion position. Marjorie, I'm so glad that you're here. Obviously, this is a complicated landscape now.
Yes. Wow. And that was quite a wrap up. I think it's a good synopsis of where we stand 2 years after Dobbs.
That's right.
We would like to have been in a position where we could save every single unborn child. We could serve every mom that has need. But what we've experienced is an enormous blowback. And everything that you just communicated is the expression of that. So I think what we're trying to do, and we can go through the various things that you just went through, what we're trying to do is, honestly, at this point, you know what an unmitigated disaster is. Well, we're trying to mitigate what looks to be a disaster and a falling apart at the center of the commitment of the Republican Party on pro-life.
So there are two ways to look at this when we address what Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance have expressed in their positions about the life issue, right? Mm-hmm. You could say maybe this is a career move. They want to be vice presidents, or they're trying to do politically what you just said, mm-hmm. kind of mitigate this ongoing fear that we're going to keep losing on the life issue at the ballot box. Which one is it?
Well, it's a huge disappointment, like Jeannie said, that that either of them would say either of those things, especially the categorical commitment to access to mifepristone is just unacceptable. Both of those statements were unacceptable. I do think they, in a misguided way, are trying to finesse, nuance the politics with a presidential nominee who has committed only to states and him and himself having no job to do as president. And so that's what everyone is trying to do. Everyone is trying to pull something good out of a very difficult environment. I'm not going to apologize for their commitments. I would comment on the platform, though. The platform, we have been, I guess I would say, another place where we're looking at unmitigated disaster and kind of trying to mitigate what could have been a complete and utter disaster. And the very beginning of the platform language, it eliminates much from the past. But in the Trump administration's effort to boil it down to just like a few sentences on each, they eliminated an essential piece, but they retained an essential piece moving forward, retaining the pro-life movement, our nation's ability to justify federal legislation, to be able to save every child, not just children in Oklahoma. Not just children in Oklahoma, but children in California as well. The 14th Amendment is a federal amendment, obviously. It requires the Congress to enforce it. So it is, by definition, a federal commitment. So for that reason, Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, and I praise that part of the platform commitment. Because of it, the Republican Party is able to retain its commitment to a national pro-life platform and still work for that. The bottom line is, this platform is going to have to be completely redone in 4 years. But the most urgent thing that has to be done is we have to defeat Biden and Senate and House Democrats, who would pass a law to wipe out every single pro-life protection in all the 24 states that are now saving children.
Now, Marjorie, where did this come from? I mean, I do think it's important to share what you wrote so carefully about this GOP commitment. You said it's important that the GOP reaffirmed its commitment to protect unborn life today through the 14th Amendment, noting that federal piece that you were talking about. Under this amendment, it's Congress that enacts and enforces its provisions. The Republican Party remains strongly pro-life at the national level. How did we get here? Why did this discussion come about where there was this big fear? Is it because we had already had this great victory with Roe versus Wade? What were the circumstances that caused this change?
It's the right question. And I think beyond this conversation we're having today, the entire pro-life movement, leaders and grassroots, we need to be in this conversation. How do we get to a place where we're in a place of worrying that the bottom might fall out?
Yeah.
And I think it's because the moneyed interests on the pro-abortion side, the courage and aggressiveness on the pro-abortion side, and the fear and lack of funding and putting heads in the sand strategy on the part of Republican leaders across the board. These are Republican leaders, House, Senate, presidential candidates who would not speak out, who would not communicate in declarative sentences that unborn children should be protected and their mothers should be served. And instead, they just hoped we could talk about Afghanistan, we could talk about inflation, we could talk about anything but the death of a child that will happen that very day. So I think that's why we're there. If after Dobbs, moving into the last midterms, there had been a very strong point of leadership that we kept asking over and over again to have a federal limit at some point, and that would be contrasting with the Democrats in a way that serves our own future, then we would be in much better shape. Instead, we have a nominee that formerly was for at least a 20-week limit, now saying not even that. And that, and so I think we do have to say that having that 14th Amendment piece in the platform, which we shouldn't even have to think or worry about the platform, but we do, means that we have a placeholder. And that it's really important for our movement, us, everyone watching, to nurture those next leaders that are coming up after we've learned a 2-year lesson that what we did didn't work. Didn't work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it didn't work. And it's not working.
Right.
When you think about the landscape at the state level moving forward, and is there anything that gives you hope? Do you have hope for a signal of this bolstered pro-life movement that you're discussing here?
The two things that I see hope for is the, well, one is just that I see this every day, today, the enthusiasm in the battleground states with all the door-to-door activity. There will be 10 million people reached by our folks in battle and presidential and Senate battlegrounds. 4 million of those will be visits at the door, actual conversations for everybody who's home about what's at stake, why this is important, what is that contrast. There is enthusiasm about defeating Biden, and that may be a negative enthusiasm. However, it means the flame is alive. We know the wolf is at the door. We cannot let him in, and that we have something to build on. Sometimes we do best in negative environment. It does draw us together. The other thing that I think is exciting is that I do think the thing that we just talked about head in the stand, the and the ostrich strategy, all that. I really do think that Republicans have learned that this is not going to work. That whole idea is, by definition, cowardice. And you either define yourself and your opponent, or you will be defined and you'll lose.
With that definition, then, just quickly, we have 1 minute left. Do you think that the Democrat Party's move to make abortion the central part of their platform this round was a mistake?
I think it was smart if our candidates continue to do what they've been doing. But I think it was a mistake if what I see moving forward now is true. And that is a full-throated, okay, we screwed up in the midterms, we're going to have to fix it now. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that it could be a mistake. I think they've overreached, as they often do, in ways that led to the overturn of Roe versus Wade. And I think they're doing it again now, and I think we could very possibly turn this thing around. Faith, hope, on our knees. Unity in the moment that seems really difficult is where we need to be.
Well, that's at least a hopeful assessment moving forward. Thank you so much, Marjorie.
Thank you always, Monsi.
Yeah. We continue our discussion on abortion cases at the Supreme Court now with our next guests. But first, let's recap the two historic pro-life cases the Supreme Court dismissed. The nine justices unanimously rejected FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, a lawsuit that challenged the Food and Drug Administration's safety measures on the abortion pill mifepristone. As a result, the drug remains available to patients without an in-person doctor's visit and can be received through the mail. The High Court also dismissed Idaho and Moyle versus United States, leaving in place an order by a federal judge in Idaho that blocks the state from enforcing its abortion ban. This means Idaho hospitals receiving Medicaid funding must allow abortions to be committed in emergency rooms. For more analysis on these cases, Steve Aden, Chief Legal Officer and General Counsel at Americans United for Life, and Sarah Parshall Perry, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. This was indeed a consequential Supreme Court term, one that didn't have the kind of splash that we had 2 years ago with the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Steve, what are your impressions of the Supreme Court's abortion cases this round?
Well, both these cases had one key thing in common, and that is both were resounding victories for the rights of conscience of pro-life doctors and nurses. In the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case, although the court did unanimously say, look, you don't have a legal right to come in and challenge the approval of RD-46 chemical abortion, that case will go forward with three states, Idaho, Missouri, and Kansas, continuing to litigate it. And the court also said quite a lot about the rights, the federal rights protected under law of pro-life doctors and nurses. And the main thing they said was that although you as pro-life doctors can't challenge this law, it remains true that you can't be forced to provide chemical abortion. And that's a key finding. They can't be forced to provide it. They can't be forced to participate in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case, I think, was the most resounding victory in its language for the healthcare rights of conscience of our pro-life doctors and nurses that I've seen probably ever from the Supreme Court. In the Emtala case, similarly, the court said, look, you can't force pro-life ER personnel to do abortions. That also is a very strong holding and one that pro-life doctors and nurses, I'm sure, will take to the bank as they defend the right to life in this country.
And as those other cases that you mentioned make their way up through the courts, Sarah, did you have the same impression of the end of the term?
Yes, I did. And it's important to note that these were two procedural outcomes. So in the instance of Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA, as Steve said, this was simply a holding that the doctors and the physician organization lacked a cognizable interest that they could trace directly to the FDA's actions in 2016 and subsequently in 2020. That was ultimately simply a disposition on whether or not those individual plaintiffs had a claim against the FDA. But as Steve noted, it's important to recognize that the litigation will now go forward on behalf of states who are representing those claims against their citizens, well within their right to do so. In the EMTALA case, this was a case about federal preemption. And what the Supreme Court did was issue a dig order, dismissed as improvidently granted. And Justice Barrett's rationale was simply that the rationale of both parties, their arguments, their concessions had changed at the appellate level, and the emergency positioning of the state of Idaho was not appropriate in this case, so the underlying litigation will continue. This was simply a temporary victory for the Biden administration, but no doctors will be forced to violate their conscience rights when they are in an emergency room faced with a situation that requires an abortion to be performed.
Those were certainly wins that didn't carry into the mainstream media. Stephen, let's play a game here on hypotheticals. While the pro-life movement was disappointed in the mifepristone case loss, what kind of case would have been successful? What kind of case should pro-lifers be looking at bringing?
Well, I think you're looking at the case the states are bringing now. The case is continuing, and a successful case will have those states win on their charge that the Food and Drug Administration acted illegally and without regard to women's safety in approving chemical abortion. That's what the trial judge said, Matthew Kaczmarek, and he set aside the entirety of chemical abortion's approval. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals went halfway and said, well, we can't go back and challenge the original approval, but these rules that you've issued loosening the availability of chemical abortion, for example, allowing it to be sent by mail, not requiring that it be dispensed in person, not requiring that abortionists report the consequences of taking chemical abortion, those things you can challenge. So a victory by the states could be the whole thing. They could demonstrate, and I think they have a very strong ground for doing so, that the Food and Drug Administration acted outside of its authority and against women's safety by approving chemical abortion as safe and effective.
Now, Sarah, Steve just used one of the big buzzwords of the term authority. Did overturning Chevron, that case about the fishermen and the regulations out of government agencies, it wasn't about abortion, but it did change government agency power. Did that give an opportunity to slow down this aggressive pro-abortion agency mandate that usually come out from Democrat administrations?
Absolutely. In fact, we saw the rule that was forcing Veterans Administration hospitals to become essentially voluntary abortion clinics. That was the final rule on abortion that the administration issued. Now that Chevron's overturned, rules of that nature are going to be essentially straight in the crosshairs. We now have the opportunity to challenge things that the administration has done and for which they have essentially exploited what they perceive to be any ambiguity in the law. But the Supreme Court was very clear. It is our duty to enforce the law and to say what the law is. That dates back to Marbury versus Madison in 1803. That is going to make a significant impact on this administration and on the use of the administration going forward. Whether that's Republican or Democrat in the White House, the administrative state, as we all know, has grown too big. The bureaucracy is too large. It is too impactful. And we've seen multiple times those particular administration rules struck down. I think this was the final death knell for the growth of the administrative state, and it puts the power back in the hands of the people and their elected representatives to enforce and enact laws that are representative of the wishes of their constituents.
Well, it certainly is a motivator for those who are considering not showing up at the ballot box to really come out in droves. Stephen, what is the Supreme Court then set to review next term related to abortion? What should we be looking out for?
Well, Monse, this case actually involving transgender surgery could be critical. One of the questions that the Supreme Court left open in the Dobbs case, which overturned Roe versus Wade, was, is there any longer a requirement, as the court had previously said under Roe, that if a minor wanted an abortion, a state had to give her a legal mechanism to get one, to go through the courts without parents' knowledge or consent? Is that rule still effective after Dobbs? We don't think so. And that's really the critical question in this case the Supreme Court will consider next term, whether it's transgender surgery or whether it's abortion on minors. Can parents be cut out of the loop? We don't think so. We think that parents actually have a constitutional right as parents to participate in their children's medical care. And we do believe the court will say so this coming term.
Sarah, are there any cases that you're watching in particular, any at the state Supreme Courts?
I think definitely we're going to see some challenges on a continuing basis to some of these ballot referenda that have been instituted after they've shown up in the ballot box. We've seen an increasing attempt by state legislatures to push through these state constitutional amendments. But it's important to note that constitutional amendments are specifically a relation to governed government. That's what constitutions are for, whereas bills, legislatures, laws are a way to govern people. So it's an encouragement to those individuals who may not have been sort of in anticipation of the election to go out and vote when there are state referenda on the particular dais. But these are very much going to be, I think, front and center during this election. We're going to see ongoing challenges to the interpretation of state constitutional law. We've moved away from the federal constitution after Dobbs, but now we're looking at state constitutions and what the definition of life or privacy or fundamental right is in those states. We've already seen a number of challenges, and I think those are going to be ongoing.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep watching those. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
When we return, spreading a culture of life for hundreds of miles across the U.S., and it's all happening on bikes. The national ride underway right now that dozens of young adults are taking part in. We'll explain when we return. Hitting the road with two wheels, a helmet, and a mission to save lives. At the start of each July, missionaries with Biking for Babies traverse the United States for about a week to raise money and awareness for pregnancy resource centers. The young missionaries have trained for months for the annual National Ride, which is underway this week. Athletes cover more than 100 miles a day. Since the mission began 15 years ago, Biking for Babies has raised more than $1.6 million for 127 U.S. pregnancy centers and maternity homes. Riders and their crews have touch points with local communities, churches, and supporters' homes along the way that provide food, shelter, and prayer and cheerleading. This weekend, they will culminate their ride from various points in the United States to St. Louis, Missouri, and Arlington, Virginia. That's where they will hold their Celebrations of Life festivals. Nikki Bees, the executive director for Biking for Babies, joins us now to share a little more about these missionaries and give us a preview of these events. Welcome to the show. Your missionaries are 18 years old up to 39 years old, and you include formation in order to be a missionary. Quickly, walk us through that formation.
Sure. So our missionaries join us in March in a virtual formation program. So they join us from anywhere across the country. We've even had missionaries join us from Canada or Northern Ireland. And they really encounter the gospel of life. They enter into spiritual formation and a physical preparation for this week-long event. And they also get partnered with a pregnancy center. We really believe that it's that virtue formation and that transformation that's going to renew a culture of life.
And what is then the average participant's age? How many people nationwide sign up every year?
So our average missionary's age is 27, but like you said, 18 to 39. And we've had about 80 missionaries on a ride this year. We had last year 69.
Wow. So you've got young people in their mid-20s that are going around the country on bikes trying to save lives. What's the reaction on the ground with these long bike rides?
Gratefully, people are so excited to see us and cheer us on. As you said, our generous host families are always praying for us and cheering us on. And then the, you know, passersby that see what we're doing, we want to get attention. We want to be very visible as we witness to life. And people ask questions. What is this about? What are you doing? You're all matching in your jerseys and your shirts. And we get to share the beauty and the gift of every life. And generally, people are very excited to see young people putting their faith and their beliefs into action and supporting these women who need us.
Have you seen any significant pro-life impact culturally from these rides?
Absolutely. As I said, it really starts with that personal transformation and encountering Jesus on the ride. There's always, you know, very big moments of conversion in our own hearts and then in the hearts of our families and those that we meet along the way. Many people who really question whether or not abortion should be available or is even necessary meet us, and we get to invite them into a conversation. And it's those conversations that really allow people to have a change of heart about what's needed in response to an unplanned pregnancy.
Well, now the riders are making their final 100-mile leg of their races this Saturday, arriving in St. Louis and Arlington. What do you expect this weekend at your Celebration of Life events?
Yes, so these events are tremendous in celebration of these 80 individuals who have traversed the country. And we want anybody to come out and celebrate with us. They're free events. So the information is on our website, bikingforbabies.com/events. And we celebrate life. We get to hear from a woman who was served by one of our partnered pregnancy centers, sharing her story about how she was unexpectedly pregnant and how that center and her community rallied in support of her. And we invite people to give so that we can continue to form these missionaries and support these women in crisis.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much. We'll be praying for your efforts this weekend.
Thank you so much.
And that does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like us and follow us on X, Facebook, and Instagram, and to sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse. Just visit EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.